Hello, this is Glenda Taylor. Welcome to this One and All Wisdom podcast. Today's podcast is the second in a particular series of podcasts, and there will be two more in this particular series. In the previous podcast, I invited you to meander about with me, exploring all sorts of random things relating to some of the major issues of our time. I resisted giving this meandering a specific title because I wanted to elaborate and expand rather than to narrowly define our focus on what I think is happening in today's increasingly splintered, chaotic, and challenging world. I often find it difficult to focus on just one thing and say something about it because any one thing always intersects with and has roots in everything else. When I ignore this vital truth, I fall into a single-minded or one-sided place. But all the enormous change happening in our world today is so important, so overwhelming, that while it's impossible for me to make simple definitive statements about the whole big complex picture, it is possible to point out various elements of backstory and connecting threads that help broaden and deepen our understanding, hence the meandering. It's something like what the Swiss psychologist Carl Jung said when attempting to describe Zen Buddhism. He said, quote, "All you can do is maneuver through the neighboring proximity," end quote. Maneuver, meander, work your way around. We are trying, by seeing various parts, to get a better picture of the whole. But it's not easy. As novelist Naomi Alderman says about today's discussions around gender and sexual identity, for example, gender is a shell game. What is man? Whatever a woman isn't. What is a woman? Whatever a man is not. Tap on it and it's hollow. Look under the shells, it's not there. End quote. So again, instead of my going straight to a direct statement about things I care deeply about, I want again to explore freely and randomly tangents and backstories and current commentary that connects to these issues. My hope is that we can include many perspectives without being blocked by our already made-up minds. I, like the new kitten in our household, want beginner's mind. I want to poke around and touch upon all sorts of things that may be affecting our thinking and our behaviors, even if we aren't aware of it, without negating or endorsing any of them. So at the end of the previous podcast, after discussing the terms binary and non-binary and in grammatical terms, I reminded us that throughout history, from ancient origin stories to modern scientific theories, we hear of an ever-present unity or oneness that manifests within itself diversity. The one, binary, becomes two, non-binary. And as diversification continues, two becomes more and more until there is multiplicity. We were looking at this with a broad focus in the last podcast, and during that podcast, I asked us to delay until this one, looking at binary and non-binary with reference to gender. Now I want to wander around that subject, checking out some of the differences and the reasons for differences about that. We will look today at some recent attitudes and developments, as well as some of the oldest traditions that still strongly influence us. Today, happily, in some sectors of our society, there is much emphasis on accepting or at least peacefully tolerating differences, on seeing the value of differences, and on understanding and appreciating distinctions of all kinds. I would like to hope that inclusion and appreciation of difference is increasing, for we know that that is good, but given the culture wars we're living in, and it seems more and more that the violent word wars is accurate, it becomes more urgent that we recognize how deeply entrenched some so-called norms are, and how rigid the boundaries of thought and belief are around those things. Doing so is necessary in order to anticipate and deal with some of the given minefields and booby traps that our history has already laid down for us, that are already out there ahead of us, and in here, inside of each of us, even as we continue to go forward, opening up new roads, new paths, new territory of thought, we need continually to be aware of the vast and various historical events, customs, prejudices, especially those that are tucked away in our own subconscious. Whatever our age, our experience, unexamined mental constructs shape and affect us. As Imogene Benny, an American transgender novelist, says about gender, quote, "Eventually you can't help but figure out that while gender is a construct, so is a traffic light, and if you ignore either of them, you get hit by cars, which also are constructs," end quote. Mental constructs do exist, and they affect us unconsciously, unless we make them conscious. Right now, people on all sides of the political spectrum struggle with definitions that frame our debates about gender. We find a rather clear statement in a sociology textbook now widely used at universities in this country and in Canada and available online, The Introduction to Sociology, authored by William Little. And I quote, "Sociologists and most other social scientists view sex and gender as conceptually distinct. Sex refers to physical or physiological differences between males and females, including both primary sex characteristics, the reproductive system, and secondary characteristics such as height and muscularity. Gender is a term that refers to social or cultural distinctions and roles associated with being male or female. As gender is such a primary dimension of identity, socialization, institutional participation, and life chances, sociologists refer to gender as a core status," end quote. The text goes on elsewhere, "The term sex and gender have not always been differentiated in the English language. It was not until the 1950s that American and British psychologists and other professionals formally began distinguishing between sex and gender. By the end of the 20th century, expanding the proper usage of the term gender to everyday language became more challenging, particularly where legal language is concerned. In an effort to clarify usage of the term sex and gender, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia wrote in a 1994 briefing, quote, "The word gender has acquired the new and useful connotation of cultural or attitudinal characteristics as opposed to physical characteristics distinctive to the sexes," end quote. We know that in legal cases, referring to biological anatomy rather than gender is usually preferred as the determining legal factor. But it's not that simple either. As Alfred Kinsey pointed out way back in 1948 about male sexuality, males do not represent two discrete populations, heterosexual and homosexual. The world is not to be divided into sheep and goats. The living world is a continuum in each and every one of its aspects. And as Julie Greenberg writes in an article for the Arizona Law Review called "Defining Male and Female, Intersexuality and the Collision Between Law and Biology," and I quote, "Although gender and sex are separate concepts, They are interlinked in that gender discrimination often results from stereotypes based on differences about what is expected of members of each sex and each person's gender identity. I'll go into those stereotypes and expectations around gender identity more fully in the next podcast. But as we are thinking about this increasing terminology and distinctions and definitions today, some old-timers like me, open-minded though we may be, automatically think we know what's being talked about when in fact often we don't. Just as some of the younger folk at the forefront of the movement for change can be unaware of many deep residues and implications of previous terminology, thinking that it's all over and done with when clearly it's not. Here is a bit more sharpening of definitions around what is now called gender identity. Gender identity is an individual's self-identity. Cisgendered, C-I-S, gendered, individuals identify with the gender and sex they were assigned at birth. Individuals who identify with the gender that is the opposite of their biological sex are transgendered. And there's gender-neutral identity. And then there's heteronormative gender identity, with heterosexuality as the preferred or normal mode of sexual orientation. And there is pangender or omnigender or gender-fluid identity, persons who self-identify with a number of separate identities that they are fluid between over time, or they identify as all-encompassing, sort of an all-of-the-above category. The term pangender is also used in certain communities to mean all genders inclusively. And there's choices made about the use of gender-related pronouns, he, she, they, and so forth, that I keep stumbling over in my efforts to get it right. So there's a lot of fine-tuning around these definitions. But it is extremely important to pay attention to this. As Little's sociology textbook states, quote, part of having a sexuality or a gender has to do with the naturalness with which an individual assumes one of the most fundamental identities that define their place in the world. However, having a gender or sexual identity only appears natural to the degree that one fits within the dominant gender scheme. And here's the kicker in this quotation. The dominant gender scheme is an ideology that, like all ideologies, serves to perpetuate inequalities in power and status. End quote. Our textbook goes on, pointing out a feminist perspective I'll talk about more in the next podcast. As the capacity to differentiate between the genders is the basis of patriarchal relations of power that have existed for 6,000 years, the dominant gender schema is one of the fundamental organizing principles that maintains the dominant social order. Nevertheless, it is only a schema, a cultural distinction that is imposed upon the diversity of the world. End quote. The schema in our society that until very recently was dominant and still is very strong in some of our society today, so that it has to be recognized and taken into account, holds strongly that A, sex is a biological characteristic that produces only two options, male or female. And B, gender is a social or psychological characteristic that manifests or expresses biological sex. And only two options exist, masculine or feminine. All persons are either one gender or the other. No person can be neither. No person can be both. No person can change gender without major medical intervention. That's one side of the cultural divide. but increasing numbers of people are on the other side, working for recognition of diversity, inclusivity, and changes in society, legal or otherwise, to honor differences and distinctions. News reports are so full of examples of the explosive ramifications of all this that possibly many people listening to this podcast and others have become numb and just turned off to the importance of the subtleties and complexities of these issues as they do affect all of us. Well, maybe we should backtrack to see where that dominant schema in our culture came from. One of the places that it came from, of course, is the creation myth that has most directly influenced us all and bears most heavily on our current debates around gender and appreciation of differences. Let's meander there and look more closely at that. It is a story that is foundational in our thinking, in our culture, and anywhere the Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, have prevailed and imprinted themselves in every aspect of culture. The shorthand version of the story, the creation myth that most people know about, is that God told Adam and Eve not to eat of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. They were to remain uninformed about evil and innocent in the Garden of Eden. And Adam and Eve really screwed up by not doing what they were commanded to do. And here we all are in our perpetually sinful world. And by the way, it was the woman Eve who got Adam into trouble. Woman. Now, hold on. Don't jump away thinking this is old hat and going to be boring. Most of us think we know that Adam and Eve origin story, that sexist creation story, all too well, beginning with the male God creating first a man, Adam, and then out of his side a female Eve, who of course got everybody in trouble. If we're dealing with gender stereotypes, you say, here's the start, forget it. But that's only one version of the story in the Torah, that ancient Hebrew text, transcribed from oral traditions even more ancient. There are, in fact, three different versions of creation in the Hebrew text, each different from the other, two of them back-to-back in the first two chapters of Genesis. One Jewish scholar has asked us not to be surprised that there are three different versions of creation, for, as he says, none of them were created in a single day. Each is a literary expression of different traditions, customs, and stories lived at different times, transmitted orally from generation to generation. And he goes on, each of these traditions also has a history, which sometimes precedes or predates the history of ancient Israel. Archaeological excavations, for example, have uncovered Babylonian versions of the stories of creation and the flood, older than the Hebrew stories, that share prominent characteristics with those later Torah narratives. And as Dr. Pete Enns, American biblical scholar and theologian, has said about the Hebrew creation stories, quote, Genesis is not the only place in the Bible where two different versions of the same story are placed side by side. For example, there are two genealogies in Genesis 4 and 5. And two accounts of the spread of humanity in Genesis 10 and 11. There are also two distinct histories of Israel, one in Samuel Kings and the other Chronicles, and four distinct tellings of the story of Jesus. So, Enns continues, quote, two-ness has a significance, and when we see two-ness of the creation story, we should pay close attention to what we can learn from this. End quote. So let's pay close attention. Scholars tell us that Genesis chapter 1, is a version of the story that comes from the northern kingdom of Israel, ancient Israel, and was written down somewhere between 900 and 700 BCE. In this version, the narrator refers to God as Elohim. Significantly, scholars tell us that some form of that word, Elohim, was found throughout the entirety of the ancient Near Eastern world, not just among the Hebrews. It was a generic and universal word in that part of the world for what might loosely be called the divine. Elohim has been translated as Supreme One, or Mighty One, or Majestic One, and so perhaps is somewhat equivalent to that unified oneness we talked about in the last podcast. At any rate, the word Elohim refers to divine beingness, mysterious and impersonal. Much like the other creation stories we discussed last time, the great, all-containing oneness manifests two-ness, light and dark, sky and land, water and earth, man and woman. And when this was done, the manuscript says in chapter 1 of Genesis, the Creator was pleased, saying, it was good. Good. It was all good, not evil. No temptations, no ordering anyone around about not eating anything. In fact, the man and woman are shown all the good things to eat and enjoy. According to Rabbi Matthew Berkowitz of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America, in the first chapter of Genesis, God's essential act over the days of creation, quote, involves manifesting separation, boundaries, and order, end quote. Just like the other creation stories from the ancient world that we talked about last time. And notably, the word Elohim is plural in form, not just unity, but also multiplicity within the one, plural, Elohim. Now let's get to the second chapter of Genesis, the one most of us are more familiar with, which is different, as we've said. In this rendition of the story, God is referred to as Yahweh, not Elohim. While Elohim is an impersonal sort of concept shared with all others in the ancient Near East, Yahweh is the personal name of the God of the people of Israel. Other peoples in the area had their personal gods. For example, the Sidonite goddess Astarte, or the Canaanite gods Moloch and Baal, among others, all mentioned by name in the Hebrew text we're talking about. But Yahweh was the Hebrews' God, who had a special relationship with the people of Israel, with Adam and Eve, and eventually with the whole of the Hebrew people. And it isn't until the second chapter of Genesis, the second chapter, that we find God walking around in the garden with Adam, chatting with him, giving him orders about what not to eat, or reprimanding Eve, a personal God. Elohim, Yahweh, two distinct versions of the divine. And let's peer ahead and notice that in the first translation into the English language of the ancient Hebrew story, a translation ordered by the English King James sometime around 1600, I forget exactly the date, but around that time, just before the English arrived on the American shores, when the title Lord meant certain very specific things relating to political power and entitlement in the English world. So in the translations of the Hebrew text into English, Yahweh was translated as Lord God, with all the connotations of privilege and power that that word Lord meant at that time in England, not in ancient Israel necessarily. And English-speaking people are still using that word Lord for God. The word Lord, with all its cultural and historical and emotional context that colors our unconscious response. We fought a revolution in America, after all, to get rid of the title of lords and royalty. but we're still labeling what we think of as the Creator in that defining way. And again, a way that would not necessarily have been the context or attitude of even the second version of the Hebrew creation story. But we've mentioned only two versions of the story, one more removed and magisterial, one more personal and directly interactive with humankind. Now let's move ourselves along to a third creation story in the Hebrew text. Christy Randazzo, a Quaker and a professor in the religious studies department at Montclair State University, has said, and I quote, "The Hebrew Bible doesn't leave the Genesis account as the only narrative of the creation. Instead, there is an entire tradition revolving around the stories and words of wisdom, Sophia, the feminine energy and presence of God." This version of the creation story is found in the Hebrew book of Proverbs, which asserts that wisdom, Sophia, identified with a feminine pronoun, was there from the beginning during the works of creation. The eighth book of Proverbs reads, speaking in wisdom's voice, her voice, says, quote, "Ages ago I was set up at the first, before the beginning of the earth. When there were no depths, I was brought forth. When there were no springs bounding with water. Before the mountains had been shaped, before the hills, I was brought forth. Before was made the earth with its fields, or the first of the dust of the world. When the heavens were established, I was there. When the Creator drew a circle on the face of the deep and made firm the skies above. When was established the foundations of the deep, and assigned the sea to its limit so that the waters might not transgress. When was marked out the foundations of the earth, I was beside him like a master worker, and I was daily his delight." Sounds like some of the other creation stories we talked about last week. And it sounds a lot like some that we will talk about in our next podcast. But Randazzo goes on to ask this question. Whose face do we see when we envision God? And who do we allow to see themselves as being made in the image of God? Male, female, neither, both? Good question. Another good question is, who gets to claim the authority to decide the answers to these questions? I quote Randazzo at length here, quote, "When the imagery used to describe the actions of God reflects the assumed cultural frameworks of male gender, it simply makes sense that men will claim authority based on the assumption that God is their gender. As God created all things and as God is gendered, gender divisions are built into the fabric of the creation, absolutely immutable." Randazzo continues, quote, "Wisdom, Sophia, in that ancient Hebrew creation story, does something radical by claiming the authority to speak as one who was present at and active in the creation of the building blocks from which creation was constructed." Randazzo says, "Wisdom, feminine Sophia, remember, wisdom is sweeping away all our usual assumptions about the nature of God, of creation, and power. Wisdom demands that we reimagine everything we think we know about God, including our relationship with God. Wisdom, Sophia, demonstrates the absolute universality of her path, rendering it impossible for any human to avoid hearing her. She is not only inviting the oppressed, the marginalized, and those who have been held captive by others' management of their access to God's love and world to throw off their shackles. She is dissolving those shackles by simultaneously dismissing the old order as mere puffs of air and establishing a new order built upon the irrevocable authority of the one who was God's only fellow worker from the beginning of the world. End quote. Wow. Quite a different version of the story, which most of us have not identified with. Which brings us in our wandering, of course, to current dismissal of the old order's definitions and power structures and authority to place different values on the pronouns he and she and all that goes with it. That will take us further in our next podcast into the territory of the roles long assigned to gender. But I'm about out of time here, I imagine. So I would like to conclude this podcast by stepping back, summarizing what has been said so far in a sort of, well, maybe sort of a whimsical way, not legal or sexual or any of that, without taking a position on any of that right now, just meandering around again and summarizing. So let's take a deep breath and relax and just imagine yourself in a trance of sleep. Delicious. Can I just stay asleep the way I am? Comfortable. 5 more minutes, or years, or lifetimes. We're being asked to awaken. Wake up. Be woke. No, just awaken to my playful imaginary game here in our ordinary way. Let's say we awaken from the trance of sleep. How then do we automatically, upon awakening, orient ourselves to the world around us? First, we might get right up, look straight ahead, ignoring all peripheries or fringes or anything outside our immediate sight lines. We allow ourselves to just get on with it in a straight ahead way. One way. Our way. Let's say that's binary. Straight as an arrow. Two, our awakening, we might be a little groggy and look first one way and then the other, up and down, right and left, not just straight ahead, looking two ways, twoism, dualism, non-binary, two-ness, two ways. Hard to look both ways at once, though, and stay focused enough to get going, so maybe we automatically go to a one or the other way of thinking. Right or left, up or down, a choice must be made now, maybe constantly, all day, all the time, this or that, everything presenting as duality, night, day, right, wrong, this opposed to that, the challenging side of two-ness, duality in opposites instead of complements, the deeply rooted orientation of our Western world is dualistic. 3. Or, on awakening, perhaps, we might instead have a practice at looking to each of the four directions, north, south, east, west, quickly centering ourselves on the whole grid of the earthly plane of reality, in which case we're not totally hemmed in by dualism. We may do as a Native American elder once instructed me to do, to sit in the middle of a circle and look to each of the four directions in considering my current issues, taking in from each of those different perspectives, seeing how I'm related to each on those different ways, and then knowing that I'm in the center so that I act in a way that takes all four directions or ways of being into account and leaves nothing out. Leaving out no 13th fairy godmother to curse us, leaving nothing out. A lifetime discipline, challenging, but oh, so rewarding, acknowledging multiplicity while remaining centered. Or 4, then again, if we are psychologically or spiritually alert, we may add other dimensions to the four directions. We may add the inward and the outer dimensions, with all that that implies. Most of us think we live primarily in the outward aspect of ourselves, but truth be told, It's the inward life in each of us that is most strongly influencing and shaping everything we do or think. Each of us does have an inward life, active, dynamic, energetic, richly endowed with awareness of its own storehouse of information that it draws on, of the impacts of the history of our species, of life itself, of ways of being and their consequences that have occurred over vast reaches of time, of archetypes and instincts and prejudices and family histories and deeply embedded earth wisdoms. It's all in there, in our inner life. Even below the level of our awareness, our inner lives are nonstop, constantly active, dealing with background motivations and assumptions and expectations and drives that move us. Our inner lives are not just repositories of memories of actual events, of childhood trauma or wonderment, but also our inner lives are purposeful engines of energy shaping and propelling us. And so on awakening from our dream of sleep, we may see how our inner world is influencing all our outer actions and thoughts, most often without our having examined or paid much attention to it consciously. I'll say more about this unconscious strata of our being in a future podcast in this series, but I just mention it here because it's a possibility we need to add to our list of ways of orienting ourselves, not just binary or non-binary or whatever other term we use as some fixed, faded way that we are and are stuck with, but rather our lives are an unfolding process with deep roots in the past, but with parts of us already reaching into the possibly new and different future, unfurling ourselves in ever new possibilities. So let's call that a multidimensional, dynamic, process-oriented way of being, an interactive multiplicity, a healthy, interactive, interdependent mutuality. And 5, if we're blessed and lucky and aware enough on awakening and orienting ourselves each day, we may simply acknowledge all at once all of that, and that all that exists around us and within us. We use a holy phrase like all my relations, as the Native Americans say, or by some other means, we may acknowledge that all is all related to me, interactive with me, akin to me, part of how I'm doing things all day long, every day. In other words, we may orient ourselves to being immersed in the multiplicity and complexity, so that we are all contained in the one great beingness of life itself, the one, the unity. We may orient ourselves that way rather than experiencing ourselves as divided, dualistic, separate, cut off, seeing our own way as being over against any otherness different from us. If we can orient ourselves to be free in that perception, we can say, as the song of the Old Crow Medicine Show says, we are all in this thing together. Walk in the line between faith and fear. This life don't last forever. When you cry, I taste the salt of your tears. We're all in this thing together, however we are. And we're all not only in this together, if we're paying attention, we can see that it's all happening in us and around us, all levels at once. Voices and drives from all levels and all ways of orienting ourselves. Say that again. We are functioning on all levels at once. For as the Buddhists say, everything is mutually arising. What does that mean, mutually arising? All happening at once, and from within the same source. The Buddhist poet and activist Thich Nhat Hanh said, we need the vision of interbeing. We belong to each other. We cannot cut reality into pieces. The well-being of this is the well-being of that. So we have to do things together. Every side is our side. There is no evil side. Quote. The Sufi poet Kabir wrote, quote, "The river and its waves are one surf. Where is the difference between the river and its waves? When the wave rises, it is the water, and when it falls, it is the same water again. Tell me, where is the distinction? Because it has been named as wave, shall it no longer be considered as water?" Psychotherapist Janine A. Davis has written, "Because people suffer together, and indeed often suffer because of one another, so too do they share in the capacity to develop the consciousness that is necessary to transcend the conditions that propel this mutually arising fabric of human experience." End quote. Mutually arising, both and, the past, the possible future, all at once, water and wave, the one in the individual, the one in the many. Last podcast I spoke of the Chinese yin-yang symbol, which depicts the mutually arising yin and yang, but also depicts a circle around them that is the containing wholeness of all things, containing the multiplicity. If we awaken to that reality, we move beyond mere limiting duality. And with Rumi, we can say, there are 1,000 ways to kneel and kiss the ground. Or as singer Ernest Tubb summed it up when I was a kid, "I love you for 100,000 reasons, but most of all, I love you 'cause you're you." There's a lot of different ways that we can wake up and orient ourselves automatically or mindfully, orient ourselves to life and to the changes that we participate in making. That's a good place to stop for today. I hope you will join me next time when I will share some personal stories around some of these things and look at the current events, too, surrounding gender rights and issues. Thank you for being with me here on the One and All Wisdom podcast. And visit the One and All Wisdom website for more information along these lines. Until next time.